You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host from Newark, Delaware, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on June 30th, 2013 at our new studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, in the first episode of the summer at the new studio, my new co-host Persephone joins me to discuss the Voting Rights Act decision, the DOMA and Prop 8 cases, Obama's climate speech, and Syria. All this is just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday afternoon and is available for download on Monday nights at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show locally on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. We've been off for several weeks. We're set up in my new studio now, and we have a new co-host, Persephone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill. I'm very excited to be here, and I hope this will go well.
I hope so, too. Lots to talk about since I've been off for quite a few weeks now, about a month and a half at this point, and just a ton of news happening all around the world and in the United States. I think, though, that a lot of the big news has just happened in the last week, so why don't we talk a little bit about some of the things that happened there. The Supreme Court, obviously, would probably be the biggest story from the past week, a couple, three major decisions there in two different areas. Let's talk first about the Voting Rights Act. So what happened there was that the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 margin, struck down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act from the 1960s. And what Section 4 did was that it said that most of the states in the American South, as well as the state of Arizona and some specific counties in other parts of the country that had previous records of racial discrimination with regard to voting laws and voting rights, that they had to come under special scrutiny, and the Justice Department could essentially veto any changes that they wanted to make to their laws on the grounds that they were not allowed under the Voting Rights Act because they were discriminatory. So a few years ago, a similar case had come up before the court, and John Roberts persuaded the liberals on the court to join a decision with him that said, you know, we'll come back and reassess this in a few years, and maybe think about whether or not these geographic regions warranted that specific scrutiny, or whether that was unfair. So the decision this time, which was not joined by the liberals on the court, was that the Supreme Court said that they couldn't discriminate, the Congress couldn't discriminate like that against those specific states now, that maybe this had been a problem in the past, but it wasn't a problem anymore, and that the Congress could pass similar restrictions everywhere, but they couldn't pass them for specific geographic locations. And John Roberts, I think, is a Southerner himself. I think he's from Virginia. So probably not surprising that he wants to stick up for the home region in this respect. But his I think a lot of people took issue with his central contention that this was no longer a problem in these geographic regions in the South, that this was something that was truly from a bygone era. I think, for one thing, it's only been about 50 years or so. That's a pretty short time period to be calling this problem solved and over, and that there's no risk of it happening again. The other thing that is pretty bad about this whole situation is, of course, that if you're saying, well, let's just turn it over to Congress and have them apply it everywhere, which is something that I would probably support, since I think there are some areas like Pennsylvania and stuff, some states and areas that have been passing similarly problematic laws recently. The problem with that, of course, is that the House Republicans especially, and the Senate Republicans to some extent as well, are very unlikely to want to make any changes to this and make it harder to pass things like voter ID laws. But the other issue is that just flat out it's not true that these areas that he's lifting the restrictions on are not problems anymore. And that was shown pretty quickly by, as Talking Points memo and others pointed out, that these states like Texas immediately instituting voter ID laws within hours of the Supreme Court decision coming down. And in my mind, if you were truly past this problem that you didn't need this special adult supervision from the Justice Department, and this was completely something from the past and no longer a problem, I would venture that all you have to do to prove that that's the case is just not do anything. And the fact that Arizona and Texas and Virginia and some other places immediately started trying to put in laws into effect that had previously been ruled as illegal under the Voting Rights Act, Section 4, and then Section 5. That's, to me, suggests that the problem is very much still there. So, Persephone, I wanted to get your thoughts on this case and kind of how you think this is going to play out on the ground.
Well, I think that, you know, as you said, I mean, these are clearly still problem regions. I mean, in Texas, for instance, in the past, within the past decade, there have already been voting laws that have been blocked because they were deemed to be discriminatory. So I think that that's proof that we needed Section 4 to restrict discriminatory laws. And I think that what we're going to see is even more of these laws being passed. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, Democrats in Congress will make some effort to pick up the pieces, but I really don't think anything is going to get through at this point as long as the Republicans are dominating the House.
Right. And I think the Republicans don't have any incentive particularly to cooperate on this. The cost to them is relatively low. And I would argue that the advantages to them being able to pass some of these restrictive laws is pretty high. I would note that people are saying on our side, you know, kind of the only realistic course of action at this point is to basically say, look, we've got an election in less than 18 months, and this is now going to be a serious problem. And if you're a, you know, voting rights advocacy group or something, or you know, help with low income people or people of color, especially in these states, that you want to find out as soon as possible what the new laws are going to be and start getting people registered to vote, start getting them their proper identification that they're going to need, that kind of thing. Just, you know, play along with it to the extent possible. And just make sure that you can get as high turnout as you can possibly get. And that was something that worked pretty well, I would argue, in 2012, that there was so much attention on these really problematic laws that and attempted bills in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and across the American South with voter ID laws and things like that, that there was so much attention that people made sure that they had their IDs and came out to vote. But it can't be overstated the potential impact here, because most of the analyses show that if, say, African-American turnout had been maybe 3 points lower or something proportionally from that population, that would have been enough in a whole bunch of battleground states to tip the advantage to Mitt Romney, and he would have then won the election. I think that if the outcome of the presidential election can be changed by some states having different voting rights laws and voter restrictions, that's a pretty serious issue, that's why it's going to be all the more important that we get that we repeat this in 2014 and make sure everyone gets all their paperwork together and everything. But these laws definitely adversely affect specific populations, and that really can't be denied, as much as the proponents would like to claim. For example, you know, I was moving recently and dealing with a lot of that, and it is not that easy to move, especially if you've been in an apartment or you're moving from one kind of not long-term location to another not long-term location, because your driver's license has the address that you were at, your car registration has the address that you were at. If you try to change any of that, even if you're, say, moving to the other side of the street or something, that is all now technically invalid. And so, you know, and it's not, people say, oh, well, it's just $20 or whatever. But I mean, think about what a hassle it is to go to the DMV. So if you have to go to the DMV you know, once a year or something to get, you know, pay $20 or $40 depending on the location and get a new driver's license or something, or get a new voter ID if your state has a specific ID for that that's not the driver's license, and you have to change that. I mean, that's going to affect people who move around a lot more, which is typically going to be some of the lower income populations and people of color. And I just think that it's a real shame, because if you can't win an election without resorting to stuff like this, you're doing it wrong. I mean, you know, and I don't know what your thoughts on that are, but that's just my feeling is, like, you shouldn't have to do that to win.
Well, I mean, I think that it's really, you know, emblematic of a larger problem, which is, you know, people are talking about reforming the Electoral College. How can you even consider that when we can't even, you know, prevent discriminatory voting laws? I mean, the entire structure of how voting in this country works, it's not really completely just. There are a lot of issues, and I think that this is just adding one more big problem to sort of the stack of problems with voting in the United States.
Now, because we're able to handle complex concepts and nuance, let's talk about the Supreme Court making some more positive decisions as opposed to this travesty. That, you know, I think we can definitely differentiate between the Supreme Court messed up on this thing and the Supreme Court made the right call on this thing. Some people are like, oh, well, you can only, you know, celebrate or condemn or whatever, and you can't do both. I think also just, you know, recognize that it is an institution made up of 9 people who can sometimes make mistakes or be, you know, a little idiosyncratic for sure, and it doesn't make sense to try to make them into these infallible heroes or something like that, or oracles of judicial wisdom in the United States. So let's talk about the Defense of Marriage Act and Proposition 8 case. I want to start with the Proposition 8 case. I think that one's a little bit more cut and dried to some extent. Basically, there the people who would have to defend the suit in the state of California would be members of the state of California, the state government there, and the governor and attorney general, both Democrats. Not really interested in defending the Proposition 8 constitutional amendment in court, so they dropped it. And then other outside groups like the National Organization for Marriage and other folks picked up that fallen flag, essentially, and tried to run with it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the there had been persistent question of whether or not they had the standing to do that. So standing, for those who don't know, means whether or not you're basically allowed to contest it in court, or whether you're contesting it in the correct court. And the lower circuit courts had said, hey, you know, we're not sure if they have standing, but if they have standing, then, you know, this is how we'd rule, and if they don't, then, you know, but they kind of kicked it up to the Supreme Court and said that they didn't really know for sure whether or not it had standing. And the outcome basically is that if they didn't have standing, then the lower court's decision saying that they that the marriages should resume immediately would go into effect. Now, what the kind of decision that the lower court had said was, we don't think that it's constitutional for the state of California to give rights through their courts to have same-sex couples get married and then take them away at the ballot box, that's unconstitutional. The Supreme Court kind of ultimately punted on that entire thing. They didn't really want to address the merits of that decision, and they just kind of went with they said that the defendants representing the state of California did not have the standing to represent the state of California as non-government people. And that they also didn't really address the core of the lower court decision. So they weren't the appeals court had actually said this would apply anywhere in the Ninth Circuit, which is a pretty broad area of the West Coast, except that it wouldn't really apply outside of California because California was the only state that had given rights and then taken them away. But the Supreme Court said, okay, we're just gonna say that they didn't have standing, and that goes back to whatever the last court said regarding what happens if they didn't have standing, and that was ultimately that they would start doing the marriages. And initially it was thought, oh, it's going to take several, you know, a month or whatever, but they started issuing the licenses. And so California, everyone's getting gay married in California now, everyone. But people were kind of interested in who voted in favor of doing this, and it was the conservatives on the court voted to basically let the marriages start happening. And initially I was a little bit puzzled by that, but I was giving it some thought, and I think that probably what happened, and we can't know for sure because it's a pretty opaque institution, but probably my guess is that there were four votes for finding a much broader decision saying, yes, they have the constitutional right to, you know, get married, blah, 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 or going along with the broad decision by the lower, by the appeals court saying that the state cannot give rights and then take them away. The conservatives, there were probably four votes there for saying, no, we don't want any marriages happening at all, whatever. But Chief Justice John Roberts has shown time and again since he got appointed to the Supreme Court that his strategy is, you know, unlike, say, Scalia or Justice Thomas, he doesn't want to go down in flames. He doesn't want to just make a point and do Custer's last stand at the Supreme Court or whatever. He wants to come out with the most optimal decision that he can possibly get, which is one reason that he's actually been in the majority a pretty surprising number of times, even when it's a pretty much evenly split court. So what I'm guessing is that he said, instead of having five votes from the liberals and Kennedy, which we already know was happening on the other case that we're going to talk about in a minute, the Defense of Marriage Act cases, he said, instead of having them find a broader right that potentially sets up a challenge down the line for a, you know, sweeping Supreme Court decision finding, say, in 5 years from now, finding a constitutional national right to marry for same-sex couples, he said, let's have the four conservatives and Kennedy get together. Well, Kennedy's also a conservative, but he's the swing vote in this case. Let's have those five votes get together and find a really, really narrow ruling that says the case lacks standing, and we're just going to bump it down to the lower court. So the Supreme Court never had to find a broader right to marry than that. They just had to kick it down to the other court. And the outcome is that couples can get married in California, but it's better from their perspective than finding a big right now. And Kennedy was also probably, I would suspect, a little bit nervous about finding a huge right when there still aren't that many states that allow same-sex marriage. So that's kind of my guess about what happened there. So before we get to the Defense Marriage Act, Persephone, let's get your thoughts on the Proposition 8 cases.
I would say that's a pretty good analysis. I think also that in light of the Defense of Marriage Act decision, it really just shows once again this sort of emphasis among conservatives on the Supreme Court to advocate for states when it's in their interests, and to sort of emphasize the power that states have in decision making. And not allowing and limiting the amount of federal power over institutions like marriage.
That was the other interesting angle that I think people were looking at with regards to, as you mentioned, with regards to the Defense of Marriage Act, which is, was it going to be a pro-equality decision or a pro-states' rights decision that happens to be in support of equal rights, assuming, of course, that it was going to be five votes in favor of overturning, which it ended up being. And that was widely, you know, believed that was going to happen. Now, the interesting thing is, so I was kind of expecting, yeah, this is going to be a pretty narrow decision, and it's going to be mostly based on states' rights. Now, in terms of the rhetoric of Kennedy's decision there, he ended up de-emphasizing the states' rights. But in terms of application, it was very much in support of states' rights. That is saying, well, look, several states have already allowed marriage equality to happen there. And so ultimately, the Supreme Court can't allow this unfair situation to occur where the Supreme Court, Congress is saying, look, at a federal level, some marriages count and some don't. He was saying, you know, that in terms of application, we're going to let the states continue to decide this. Rhetorically, he did include a lot of really pro-equality stuff, you know, kind of saying this is going to happen eventually. and that he didn't really see much of a reason for it to be a problem, but he also stopped short of finding some sort of national right to marry. So I definitely agree that it was a states' rights decision, and it was kind of the one I was expecting. But what I was starting to say was that the interesting thing about this is that neither side was arguing that way. There were the pro-DOMA side, represented by the House of Representatives, House Republican majority in this case, because the Obama administration didn't want to defend it, and they do have standing because they are part of the government. The pro-DOMA side saying, we believe that this should be enforced everywhere nationally, and the anti-DOMA side saying, well, we think that it's unconstitutional broadly and that everyone should be able to get married. And I was kind of, I understand sort of, they were probably of two minds about this. If you argue in the state's rights way, you have a pretty good chance of winning, and they ended up getting that without even arguing it. But the problem with arguing the state's rights strategy is that you are effectively giving license to states to continue to not allow marriages. By arguing in the broader way and winning, they have now done kind of the Roberts strategy of laying the groundwork in a case now for a subsequent case later. And so that is probably going to have proven to be a good decision. And like I said, I understand where they were coming from. It's kind of like when you have those, when you're dealing with the ballot initiatives in states, and unfortunately, a lot of these states have put constitutional bans in, kind of like California, but they had done them without taking away rights, so there wasn't as easy a way to challenge that case. They're saying, you know, well, in order to overturn that, like in a state like Ohio or Michigan, where it's being talked about, or potentially Florida, but the ones that I'm definitely hearing a lot about are Michigan, Ohio, and Oregon, is saying, yeah, let's overturn this with a constitutional amendment, kind of counter amendment several years later, but that's going to have to go through the ballot box. Nevada is also working on that. That's going to probably not come up until 2016 on the actual ballot, though, because of the way they do it there. But they're saying, you know, they're realistically, that's how you have to do it if you want to get it done. But opponents of that strategy are saying, well, we shouldn't be putting people's human rights and civil rights on the ballot. That's a terrible idea, and you should not. That's subjecting it to kind of majority whims, and it was a mistake to have it on the ballot in the first place. And so the other kind of thought there is, oh, well, if we find a national right to marry, then that automatically gets rid of all those bans. And that's going to take a while, and so I would suspect there's going to be kind of a mixed strategy, but I can understand the hesitance to pursue a strategy that explicitly endorses a states rights approach from the left of saying, well, some states have decided that it is banned, some states have decided that it's allowed, we should just let the states decide, and then the federal government has to go along with whatever the individual state has decided. So,
well, I can't help but wonder, you know, obviously this was a decision, the one I'm about to refer to, was a while ago and a completely different court, but I am wondering whether sort of the results and the current standing of Roe v. Wade might have influenced how they handled this decision, because, you know, the response to Roe v. Wade was to have all of a sudden all these states that might have eventually broadened their abortion law, you know, immediately started doing everything they could to restrict abortion access. So I can't help but wonder, I mean, obviously, you know, over half the states, you know, have some sort of law about restricting gay marriage. So in a way, it's a bit after the fact, but I can't help but wonder if the thought in phrasing it this way was that, well, maybe these states will eventually overcome on their own if they don't feel imposed upon by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I think probably an even stronger parallel there would be the Loving v. Virginia case, that the court waited to strike down interracial marriage bans until after a majority of the states, actually 26 states, I think, had allowed those marriages to happen. And so, like I said earlier, I think your analysis is on point there, that Kennedy was reluctant probably to be striking it down now, but he's planting the seeds for a decision in, say, 5 years to find that it's constitutional everywhere, if he's even still on the court at that point. Although, I you know, It'll be interesting to see how fast that evolution is allowed to happen, because I think people would be kind of wondering, not that they really have any recourse if they wonder these things, because it's the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court can do whatever it wants, but that they might be wondering, like, well, why is it that 5 years ago it wasn't okay, but now it's okay or whatever? But people will probably get over it. But yeah, I think that they're probably, like I said, they're hesitant when there's the few number of states in place that do allow that. So I guess it's, let's see, it'd be what, 12 or 13 now, probably, plus the District of Columbia. I'm having trouble keeping track because we've now effectively added this year alone Rhode Island, Delaware, Minnesota, and California to the list. But that's still not, it's not a majority. And I don't know if they'll wait until there's actually a majority, but I think, yeah, they definitely don't want to have a Roe v. Wade style backlash. It worked out to wait with Loving v. Virginia until a majority of states already allowed it, and then you strike down everywhere else. But that you, yeah, you do get the backlash effect with Roe v. Wade when they decided it like that, and then a lot of states were already moving in that direction and then immediately started moving back again. And then we wind up in 2013 with, situations like North Dakota having a 6 week ban. So after 6 weeks, no abortions are allowed, which is, as a past co-host Sasha said, that doesn't even make sense, because a lot of people don't even realize they're pregnant until after that point. So that's just, they basically are figuring out ways to get around the Roe, and then more specifically the Casey decision that amends Roe, of saying, like, well, we're not officially banning it, we're just pretty much functionally banning it, but only, it's not on paper. Yeah, well, while we're talking about that, did you have any thoughts on the Wendy Davis filibuster in Texas? That was what, 13 hours? That in Texas, in filibusters, you actually have to stay on topic. You can't read from the phone book or whatever. So she had to stay on topic for 13 hours and not be resting on anything or whatever. And she managed to pull that off, and prevent a very restrictive abortion ban from going into effect that was going to close down most of the clinics down to five in the entire state of Texas, which again is like the size of France, so that's pretty absurd to be putting that kind of limit on. But Governor Perry has called another special session, and so it'll probably go through in this special section. But did you have any thoughts on that stand that she took?
I mean, first of all, she's my hero. I mean, this is whatever the end result, I think it's really incredible what she did, and her standing up there, filibustering for all that time. I mean, the shoes that she was wearing, the brand of shoes that she was wearing, they have seen a spike in sales from this event. So I think that in any case, she has become a sort of, leader and heroic figure. I think that what this means for abortion rights in Texas is unfortunately not very much, because they are going to get through their ban one way or another. But I think that people are, on a national level, are going to be very upset when they do.
I think also it is important to take a stand in these situations, even when you are going to lose ultimately. I don't think there was as much resistance in North Dakota, and the consequences that got signed into law, that crazy ban got signed into law, and there's been almost no national coverage of that. Whereas everyone was watching the situation in Texas. If you make a big deal about it, you can at least attract attention and then hopefully do something. I think a lot of people have been calling for her to run for governor next year. And this could kind of catapult her into viability, especially she's more well known. And that if she, if somebody can get elected governor who's not going to do these kind of crazy things, that immediately helps, because then you have that firewall, or at least there's no one calling for a special session to do a redo on a bill like that. So I think that there is some value to taking a stand, even when it ultimately is probably going to get passed anyway. But man, it is pretty crazy that this is still happening, in this particular year.
But, you know, it may mobilize people to continue with everything that they did in the previous session. It may be that this will encourage another lengthy filibuster, and that, you know, we'll get even more activists out there preventing it from passing. And it could just go on like that and create almost a real strong opposition that will keep delaying these laws in Texas indefinitely.
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly be nice to see this sort of galvanizing a more left-leaning wave in Texas or organization or whatever. And the Texas Democratic Party is pretty disorganized and not that great at electing people statewide or even in some specific locations. And some of that's not their fault. There's been lots of extensive gerrymandering and all that kind of thing. But, I have some doubts that that's actually going to play out like that, though. I think one thing that springs to mind is the Wisconsin situation a couple years ago, that they were trying to prevent that labor law from passing, and they kind of galvanized this huge backlash. There were all these protesters showed up, people camped out in the Capitol. The law got passed anyway. They went through a ton of recall efforts for various state senators and governors, ultimately spending a huge amount of time and money to accomplish basically nothing. And that was really disappointing and frustrating. And I think, you know, it's a kind of a shame that people aren't necessarily as on point about getting it together to maintain a level of enthusiasm about these sort of things. I do agree with that kind of, you know, you'll get these bursts of attention and then people just kind of give up.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But I think also if you put concrete objectives and concrete ways of doing things in front of people, they'll be willing to do it. If you tell people all you have to do is this and this and this, that you can really get people involved who might not be involved if you just have a sort of vague, you know, try to get this law passed or try not to get it passed, where they can't really do anything.
Are we going to start doing grassroots organizing trainings on there?
I'm not sure if I would go that far, but I think that this has been encouraging to people, and hopefully it will get people thinking about concrete steps that they can take to encourage their political beliefs.
So. Now, like I said at the top of the show, a ton of stuff has been happening this week, so much so that a lot of stuff that I think would normally be getting a lot of coverage has not been getting as much coverage. To that point, I'm a little bit surprised that President Obama took this week to deliver his biggest climate change speech yet. Many observers called it the most impressive climate change speech of any sitting president ever. It seems like a weird time to deliver the speech, knowing full well that the Supreme Court was going to be dropping a bunch of key decisions around the same time. But he gave this really big speech, suggesting in it that the Keystone XL pipeline might not get approved. That decision lies ultimately with his White House and his State Department. And there's some debate over the language that he used, because he said, quote, "Our national interest will be served only if this project doesn't significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution," which, if you really parse that out, and he also said the net effects of the pipeline's impact on our climate will absolutely be critical to determining whether this project can go forward. If you parse out those words there, the problem is it doesn't significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution, so it could do it somewhat, just like, but he did say the net effects, but he said the net effects will be kind of factored in. The other problem there is that there's been some suggestion, and there's also debate on this, about whether or not the project, the Keystone project, will actually affect the carbon emissions or methane emissions one way or the other from these shale projects in Canada. The issue there is that there are now increasingly other ways of transporting some of this oil and gas that does not involve pipelines. You can move a lot of it by train now, which is actually pretty helpful for, especially for oil. It's certainly a lot harder to move a huge volume of it by train compared to a pipeline. But pipelines, as can be seen by how long this one has taken to put into effect because of all the log jams and stuff, pipelines take like 10 years to build. And they, once you build them, you're kind of stuck with them. They don't move around. Whereas the trains, you can do kind of what they've done with the extensive gas, natural gas pipeline networks in this country, which is say, oh, this particular area has a higher demand for oil. There's a mismatch here between the demand and supply of oil. Let's send in a bunch more oil and take advantage of that, and we'll make more money off of it. And that's what they've been able to do for years with natural gas, because there's much more extensive networks for pipelines there that they don't have with oil. Oil typically has been priced in such a manner that you say, okay, well, this is the national price for oil and everyone pays the same price, which means you're losing money in some areas and you're making money, more money in some areas. What you want to do is try to get it to the optimal point if you're the oil company, obviously. But the other, so there's that concern about, okay, now they're moving a lot more of it by train now than they ever have in the past, which, and that doesn't require special approval to move it across the border. So, you know, it's going to get pumped anyway. And maybe we should just accept that that's the case and then try to come up with managed solutions for handling this. One idea has been having a transit tariff on the pipeline. So basically, you would pay for some of the damage to the climate by taxing the oil as it comes across the border, imposing a tariff at the crossing point there, because it does have to cross in. But I think some people are saying, no, you know, this pipeline is going to significantly increase carbon emissions. The oil is going to get pumped anyway, but they'll pump less of it, or it'll take them longer to move some of it out, so they'll be pumping at a slower rate, that kind of thing. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not this becomes the factor that allows the president to veto it if he in fact wants to, it's never been clear if he actually is opposed to it or not. He's kind of been hedging for the entire time. But the main thrust of the speech besides that was about coal-fired power plants. Now, this has often been the target of successful regulation in the past. I talked about a lot of times on the show before that the 1990 amendment to the Clean Air Act, which was passed by a Democratic Congress, signed into law by George H.W. Bush, Republican president, was not focused on the climate change effects, but more acid rain effects. So they put a cap and trade system. This is back, of course, when cap and trade was a conservative idea, not evil devil socialism. And they said, okay, we're going to put on, you know, we're going to establish a cap and trade system. Here are a bunch of credits that you can use. You can now trade them around. If you're emitting less of this stuff, then you can sell your excess, etc. You all know the drill. And that was an enormous success. It's generally deemed to be one of the Environmental Protection Agency's most successful implementation programs of all time since it was established in 1970, is that they say, okay, this did bring down acid rain in the United States, and that was generally focused on reducing sulfur dioxide and other similar emissions coming from the coal-fired power plants. Now, before it was passed, there was all this talk, oh, this is going to destroy the economy because coal-fired power plants provide about 50% of electricity for the United States. So that's going to drive up everyone's electricity costs, going to make everything more expensive, so on and so forth. Ultimate result was that the economy has actually grown as a result of this program, because first of all, a whole bunch of companies got to make, sell, and install these scrubbers that they put on the coal-fired power plants. That generated a lot of economic wealth that otherwise would have just basically, you know, gone into a Cayman Islands account for this power company, probably. And they also tremendous economic impact of reducing the damage of acid rain and also some of the damages of people breathing in coal dust, which, spoiler alert, is not good for you.
Really?
And yeah. It's helped to keep people a lot less sick and has actually had a net positive impact on the economy. And so people are saying, okay, well, there's no chance we're going to get some huge sweeping thing through at this point with the Republican House. That's just not happening. These are people who think that compact fluorescent light bulbs are, you know, Stalinist instruments of destruction that are just going to convert us all to a massive collective situation. And, you know, all of our tractors will be taken by the Politburo. Did we want to talk about the amazing, the super amazing quote from that speech where President Obama kind of took the same approach that I am on this?
Yeah, he basically just shut down climate change deniers by saying, we don't have time for a meeting of the Flat Earth Society. So they were pretty much completely owned.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased that he took that stance, which I think is why a lot of folks like Al Gore and others who were listening to the speech were just kind of blown away by how strong it was. Now, would it have perhaps been nice to hear this in, say, the middle of 2009 instead of stuff about healthcare that was going to get bogged down and everything was going to fall apart? Because you know what actually got passed in the summer of 2009? A cap and trade bill through a Democratic House, and then it got stuck in a, wait for it, Democratic Senate. So that was kind of a colossal failure on the part of the White House, in my opinion, that they could have done this a lot earlier and they, for whatever reason, chose not to. But they said, okay, we know we're not going to get something big through now. What can we target and try to possibly get done in the next few years? And the president ultimately selected, and I don't think this is a surprise given what we've just been talking about here, selected the coal power plants to focus on there. And there were another number of other areas that he mentioned in the speech, but the specific kind of policy objective there was to and this is coming from the White House, so it probably makes it easier to go through, is ordering the EPA to regulate the emissions from power plants that already exist. So I think the EPA has already stepped in and started blocking a lot of applications for new coal-fired power plants in the United States. That has a huge environmental benefit and health benefit, probably more importantly. But they're saying now also that the EPA will step in and start imposing more regulations. And I think that the Supreme Court had previously found a few years back that the EPA does have the authority to regulate carbon dioxide within its mandate and say that this falls within existing laws of an environmental harm that they can unilaterally regulate. Now, I think Congress was trying to take away that authority, but I don't think they were ultimately successful. Now, the Republicans are basically promising just to unleash just the everything on this and try to prevent it from happening. I mean, again, I'm sure they'll try to take away the EPA's authority to do this, which they could if they wanted to, because it is, you know, a congressionally created agency. But they're saying, hey, we're going to, you know, fight this tooth and nail, and the president's saying, no, I can do this right now. And I think that if the Senate can keep it going through, then that might actually work. Definitely have to wait around and see what actually happens on this, but I am at least pleased that this was a strong speech and that it outlined a concrete action that the administration can take without waiting around for the Flat Earth Society in the House of Representatives to show up. So what were your thoughts on this speech and this particular policy announcement?
I think that it sort of sets the stage for future advancements. I don't really know what Obama is going to get through anytime soon. I think, you know, definitely a focus on coal, but I'm not sure, you know, how much time we have left for all of that. But I think that I think it's a very good thing that he took a stand. And I think that, you know, in terms of the net effects, it's a little hard to measure sort of jobs versus the future of our planet in terms of some sort of quantitative scale. I mean, it seems pretty important to me that...
Well, and I think that a lot of the analyses have shown that, as with that Clean Air Act amendment in 1990, that this is going to have a positive economic impact. It's going to help more than it hurts to make these changes now. I mean, there's been so many analyses from the Pentagon, from international bodies of saying, look, the consequences are real bad if you don't act, and they're going to have a huge impact on the economy. I mean, Las Vegas just hit its 118-degree heat yesterday, which was record-breaking for the city. Again, we're talking about record-breaking heat in Las Vegas, which is in the middle of the desert. So it probably has had highest heat before. Now, as usual, the disclaimer that you can't necessarily tie a specific weather event to the overall climate change, but I think the trend is pretty clear. And the fact that Canada recently having massive flash flooding that just you know, making a lot of people homeless and stuff, which kind of ironically, it was near a lot of the regions where a lot of this new oil and gas is coming from. There are these impacts that you have, whereas if you take action, you can create green jobs. You can create jobs to clean up these power plants and that sort of thing. You can create these various limits, and that is going to have a more positive effect than a so-called job-killing effect that you're alluding to.
Yeah, and I mean, even in places, one example, in places where we don't have all these, quote-unquote flat earthers who continue to have their heads in the sand about climate change, in Boston recently, there was, the discussion for people who are future mayors are focusing on the effects on the coastline of climate change. I mean, people that are actually affected by these changes, not people in the, middle of the country who are not on the coasts and are not seeing these rising water levels, people that are actually affected by this are really freaked out and really want to see a positive change in policy, environmental policy.
Yeah, so I agree with you that it's a good start. It's good to hear some of this rhetoric finally. We'll have to wait and see what actually happens. Part of my hesitancy too about celebrating this too early is that even though the president theoretically can unilaterally get the EPA to regulate this, it's like that backlash effect that we were talking about with Supreme Court decisions, is that, yeah, there's what you can do on paper that no one can stop you from doing, and then there's what you should do, because if you do the other thing, it will produce this huge backlash and people will stop cooperating and things will get tied up in more court battles or whatever, or they'll start resisting at the state level and that sort of thing, like passing, tax exemptions for the coal companies and stuff to, get around, whatever bizarre thing that they decided to do. That's entirely within the realm of possibility. So, let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back in just a moment with more international news in just a moment. Now that we've covered a lot of the recent top tier domestic news, Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. I'm here with in our new studio with Persephone. How are you finding the show so far, Persephone?
It's very interesting, and I really love the things we're discussing.
All right. Well, as I said at the very beginning of the show, a ton of stuff has been happening in the past 6 or 7 weeks, however long I've been off. And there's so many things we could be covering. If we had more time, we'd be talking about the protests in Turkey. We'd be talking about the protests in Brazil. Maybe we'll get to those next week. Those are equally fascinating topics individually and together. But I wanted to go back to the topic that I left off with on my last kind of bonus episode before I went on my break, which is the issue of Syria. So before I left, I was still saying, look, we can't get involved in Syria. This is just going to be a problem. Now, subsequently to that, the administration announced that chemical weapons had been used definitively in Syria, which we pretty much already knew, and that, because of his red line comment that he had made before, that this meant that the president now couldn't really not do anything in Syria. So they had to start arming the rebels, as if we hadn't actually been doing that before. And they're providing small arms, which, of course, the let's go to war at all times brigade led by John McCain and Lindsey Graham were a little bit upset because they thought we should be providing all kinds of like anti-aircraft weapons and heavy artillery and such, because they were like, well, they have enough AK-47s. They need more actual weapons that they can take out these Syrian citadels with and stuff, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not happy that the administration is now on record saying, oh, we're going to be supplying light arms to the rebels, even though they were already doing that. But I'm at least happy that it doesn't seem like it's going to go that much further. And they, you know, who knows, they could always change their minds on that. But they seem to make pretty clear they didn't have the president announce it. They had a lower level person announce it, which kind of shows how much they wanted to downplay it. And they were saying, and this is not, we don't want to escalate this because this is a gigantic mess. And as I said on the last time that I talked about this, the issue here is that you now have a situation where you have the regime, which are the Shia Alawite Arabs against the Sunni Arabs, and the regime representing, they're in control of the country, but only representing about 5% of the population. They are terrified of losing this civil war because the consequences are extremely high for them, which is not that surprising when you've spent decades and decades repressing the vast majority of your country. Now, if you look at Iraq, that was a situation where you actually had a pretty close split between the two. I think it was something like there were obviously some other smaller minorities, but in terms of the main breakdown, if you're just looking at the two main groups of Shias and Sunnis in Iraq, I think it was something like 60-40 Shia Sunni there. And so the 40% or 30 whatever of the overall population that's controlling that country, they get kicked out of power. Immediate recriminations against them for having repressed everyone for decades and decades and decades. So the regime loyalists, desperate to keep themselves in power, but then the just average Alawite people on the ground picking up arms and basically going around forming paramilitary death squads because they realize that they have to start just killing everyone because that's the only way that they're going to win this. At least they think that's the only way they're going to win this, and it's probably likely that that's the case because if they lose, they know that that's going to happen to them. And they know this because the Syrian rebels have been doing that kind of thing too. They have been going around committing atrocities. There have been multiple massacres occurring in these various locations. Across the country, civilian massacres. This has been happening on both sides by rebel groups, by paramilitary groups supporting the regime. It's just a giant, colossal ethnic cleansing mess over there. The other huge problem that makes us reluctant to support the rebels at this point is that the Al-Qaeda ties are very, very clear at this point in Syria, that they have hardline anti-American Islamist groups representing the Sunnis. And so you've now got a situation where you're basically pitting Al-Qaeda type groups and Muslim Brotherhood type groups, the more armed wings from non-Egyptian countries, against the Hezbollah Shia groups, the Alawite paramilitaries, and the regime groups. It's a huge mess. We do not want the United States involved because it is just terrible for us, and it's dangerous for the United States to get involved in any meaningful way because we put ourselves in the middle of that, and the Russians have been supplying anti-aircraft weapons to the Syrian regime to basically prevent us from doing anything in Syria. Now, there is a number of more recent problems since I last talked about this, you know, beyond these chemical weapons and the ethnic cleansing and everything. New York Times article, June 29th, by Mark Mazzetti, CJ Shivers, and Eric Schmidt, basically saying that the government of Qatar in the Gulf is causing a gigantic mess as well by supplying the rebels, including specifically the hardline Islamist rebels, with some pretty serious firepower, not necessarily the heavy artillery that maybe John McCain wants to be giving Al-Qaeda for whatever reason, but they are supplying shoulder-fired anti-aircraft weapons that can be used to take down military planes or civilian planes. That has been a problem has been implicated in several terrorist attacks, generally in various parts of North and East Africa. But it has definitely been linked to some pretty serious international incidents or national incidents, like the assassination of the president of Rwanda in 1994 that launched the genocide there. It kind of just goes to show that if you have one guy with a shoulder-fired rocket that can take out an airplane, that you can basically just start a huge mess. And so Qatar has decided that the most optimal decision for them has been to supply this to people that want to destroy everything. I would question the logic there. The other really interesting discovery, besides the fact that they've been supplying these, is that they supplied Libyan rebel groups Libya rebel groups in the civil war there against the Gaddafi regime. And when Gaddafi fell, a significant chunk of his stockpile of weapons suddenly ended up in the hands of the Gulf state here, Qatar, and they now have some very serious weapons that they acquired from the Libyan regime, and they immediately flew them to Syria and gave them to rebel groups. We are literally just playing musical chairs with weapons across the Middle East and North Africa at this point. And I didn't realize this, but I guess although we certainly supply a lot of fighter jets to countries in the region, this particular government decided at one point that they were just going to go buy some of their own stuff. So they bought directly from Boeing some C-17 military transport planes, which just makes it super easy for them to fly around and provide huge weapons to anyone that they want to. They also seem very convinced that it is a good idea for them to be backing up these Islamist groups. They are a pretty hardline regime themselves, and I guess they believe sincerely that this is the best course of action, although I think it'll be interesting once an attack happens against them how they feel about that. I think, Saudi Arabia has made some questionable investments in terrorist-linked groups, but generally they get pretty upset when those groups come back and bite them in the behind. So, that was interesting. But the other thing is that a lot of this, we're finding it out because the rebels are posting videos of themselves on YouTube doing these things. So in addition to shoulder-fired rockets, which are a problem, because you can take out like a civilian aircraft or whatever, you start having some really serious problems when rebels, specifically Al-Qaeda-linked rebels, start showing up with heat-seeking missiles. And they just magically have heat-seeking missiles now. That almost certainly came from this particular government. I think that there's very few countries that want to supply these. And so this is another reason why it's a very serious problem at this point if the United States gets much more involved, because we're basically, at this point, the people that we're nominally supporting are going to use those weapons against us pretty much inevitably. Did you have any particular thoughts on this aspect of the story?
Well, I'm actually really concerned, not just with supplying all these arms, but also with the sort of preventing of a genocide, really. We've seen that the consequences on both sides have been very severe, and there's been a lot of targeted killings and targeted attacks. And I really would like to see, I don't want it to end up to be another situation where there's a genocide going on and the United States refuses to get involved and the UN refuses to get involved. So I really would like to see some progress made now towards establishing some kind of prevention of, future atrocities.
My general position on this is that the United States can't really get involved in this because both sides are committing atrocities. And I don't know that there's much that we can particularly do to help in this situation. And as I always reiterate many times on the show, is that I always have a two-pronged test for these things, which is if you want to stage a humanitarian and military intervention to prevent something like a genocide happening, you have to ask yourselves, does the United States have the capacity to intervene and do so successfully? And will the intervention help more than it hurts? And that includes, is there a long-term plan for what happens next? I don't think that that's the case that there is. I think there's also a stalemate in the Syrian situation that the rebels have made in the last week or so. They made some ground back, but the Syrian regime had been driving them out of a lot of their major centers and making some pretty significant progress on pushing them back. I don't think that the Syrian regime necessarily outright wins the conflict. I think a lot of people now are looking at a sort of partition situation, which means a lot of people are going to be moving around internally in the country to get out of the way before the really serious kind of purging happens that we saw in Iraq. The only way that kind of ended was that everyone moved out of the mixed areas and into their own areas so that they were no longer being targeted to a significant extent. There's still some problems with that in Baghdad because that was one of the most mixed areas to begin with. But I don't see a way for the United States to get involved in this situation in a way that's going to prevent it. And there was a really interesting article to this point about in the Gazeta, which is a Russian paper. And the headline there was Major Powers in a Strategic Deadlock. This is from the English translation of this. And the kind of central thesis here was to resolve the Syrian conflict, and that would include, genocide resolution and that sort of thing. Europeans, Russians, and Americans are reviving the time-honored policy of promoting grand peace conferences, but this time the local situation is beyond their control. And I really agreed with this article that there was this major deadlock that they aren't going to be able to break in this particular situation by just having these outside powers come up with a 19th century, you know, divided up style peace conference, and that they were going to all sit around a table and come up with a solution and then impose it. That was something that has worked in some similar situations in the past. The Dayton Accords, for example, were pretty successful in eventually stopping the atrocities that were happening in Bosnia. But I suspect that, as this article says, that it's something that worked in the 19th century. It's something that worked in the early 20th century. It's not something that's going to work now. I am of the opinion that this is a problem that's going to have to burn itself out. I don't think that these people are going to want to be brought to the table. It's one thing if you can get people who are committing ethnic cleansing to stop because there's no reason for them to. It's another thing if they, in their heads, believe that if they don't stop, that it will happen to them, which I guess is something that happens in general when that happens anyway. But I would argue that if the Serbians are conducting a genocidal campaign in Kosovo against minority ethnic Albanians there, there is no risk that ethnic Albanians are going to wipe out the Serb population in central Serbia. That is not a serious risk. Whereas there is a tremendous risk, and this is why I don't see the incentive for the Syrian regime to come to the table, even if you somehow get a bunch of hardline Islamist rebels to come to the table. What is the incentive for Syria, especially when currently being backed by a major power like Russia, to say, yeah, let's come to the table. That's going to end well for us. We have 5% of the population in one area. We're going to be massacred.
Well, I think that what I'm saying is that the reason that these groups think they can get away with it is because they can. Historically, in spite of every single claim by the UN, we'll get involved, we'll do this, we'll stop genocide, that has not been the case. It has taken years and years of violence and atrocities for the UN and the United States to even consider any recent ethnic cleansings to be genocidal. And basically, this is a message that we're sending out to countries around the world, to states around the world. We're telling them, you can go on and just eliminate one of your minority groups and nobody is going to do anything. I don't think that a military intervention is at all the right approach. I think that would make us more enemies. It would make, you know, the U.S. a target of terrorist attacks in the future. Certainly with all these arms that Qatar is giving to the rebel forces, we don't really want to put ourselves in that position. But I don't think that necessarily, you know, excludes the possibility of some sort of diplomatic process. And, you know, it might be really unrealistic to say, oh, let's get everybody at a table and just talk it out. But I do think that economic sanctions, or even the promise of economic reward for if there's an egalitarian and fair resolution, if the U.S. talks about trade but strictly trade if a fair solution is reached, a solution in which there is not ethnic cleansing, there is not massive retaliation, and there's not widespread bloodshed.
Well, I do agree with the premise that you don't want to be sending this message to people around the world saying you can get away with this, which is a very bad, problematic thing to be saying. But the flip side of that is you also don't want to try to stop it unsuccessfully, because that is an even worse message to send. If the United States, my kind of thoughts on this have been, the United States cannot intervene everywhere, which does not mean that it should intervene nowhere, but it means it should be very selective of where and how it does intervene. And that's why you have to have that tenet of the capacity to succeed, whether it's military or some other thing. If you make the attempt and fail, I think that's more problematic and diminishes your ability to stop something like this happening somewhere else. You know, the next time it could be somewhere where it's very easy to intervene without a huge, tremendous problem. It could be somewhere in West or Central Africa or something where, you know, just putting troops on the ground in a significant amount could end the problem or something like that. But if you tie up resources, whether military or otherwise, in some other country, and then on top of that you fail, now you've made it impossible to intervene anywhere. So I guess my question for you then is, like, you kind of outlined some of these things, but do you really think that those are going to work? I mean, especially the non-military things. That's why I agreed kind of with this article. You know, I don't think that we should be supplying weapons to the rebels, because that's just giving more weapons for more civilian casualties, effectively. But I just don't understand, you know, what can be done there. I think certainly there's not a military option at this point. Moscow took that off the table by supplying anti-aircraft weapons to the Syrian regime that prevent a no-fly zone by NATO. But I'm just not sure what can be done diplomatically, especially if these, you know, these old diplomatic conference things just don't work. You know, I mean, maybe they could come up with some elaborate partition of Syria or something and say, okay, this is your part and this is your part. But what is the real incentive to cooperate on that? I mean, you say potentially trade or, you know, loans or grants or something like that. But I'm very skeptical about what can work, which is why I kind of think that this is going to have to burn itself out.
Yeah. I can see that it's a very difficult and complex situation. And, you know, it may be that it would not work, and most likely it wouldn't be extremely effective. But I do think that I just don't think that standing by is a good response. I think that even if you're not saying, I mean, if you're offering the possibility of grants or of trade or of things like that, if Syria ends up heading in a good direction, that's at least sending some kind of message, even if it isn't ultimately effective. And I don't think that it will be ultimately harmful in future situations, because it's not as strong a stance as we are going to send our military over and we are going to end you.
Well, I think the problem here still remains, though, is, like, who are you dealing with? I mean, on the one side, you can at least nominally deal with the Syrian regime, but then you can't rein in the paramilitary groups because the regime, whether tacitly or supporting them or actively trying to rein them in, is not going to be able to rein in people who think that the only way that they can save themselves is by killing random civilians in large groups, which is kind of the thesis there. There's also the Hezbollah fighters coming in. Partly that's just to support their old benefactors of the Syrian regime. But there is this kind of wider Shia-Sunni conflict that was reopened. It's been kind of festering quietly and simmering for a long time, but it was reopened by the U.S. intervention in Iraq. And it's a broader conflict that's breaking out there. Iran has a big incentive as a rising regional power. That's power has been made possible by the U.S. Screwing up in Iraq and taking out the main counterbalance to Iran. You've got this wider conflict that's breaking out. And on the rebel side, you don't have anyone to deal with. That, as there was one comment that I was reading, that is, like, if you go to any of these conferences, say they're having it in Dubai or whatever, every hotel in Dubai has a different group saying that they represent the rebels or whatever. To reappropriate the old Kissinger line, if you want to try to call the Syrian rebels, who answers the phone? As, you know, he originally said that about Europe, but it's like, you can't just call up and say, like, oh, we're going to give you economic incentives to stop this or whatever. Like, how do you even partition the country at that point when there's no clear leadership on one side? You can't rein in an al-Qaeda-style group. That's by definition. They have been refusing to rein themselves in or get reined in by anyone this entire time. I mean, even the Taliban couldn't rein them in Afghanistan. And the Taliban wasn't super thrilled to have them there, as was, you know, kind of validated by the United States bombing the heck out of them in 2001. So I am not seeing the route to getting these groups to stop their fighting or to come up with some sort of, like, ceasefire.
I can't come up with a solid answer, but I do think that we need to find a way to deal with these people that you can't call up on the phone. I mean, this is the future. Look at, Anonymous, for instance, and look at all these, you know, groups that are leaderless and are just sort of collective groups, I think that all governments are going to need to learn how to deal with these groups and these sort of...
So you're saying Syria is sort of the testing ground for how to deal with non-state actors that need to be constrained.
Yes.
And that's kind of the future for this century. The last century, we could still deal with like actual powers, but this century is going to be non-state actors.
I think it will be.
Well, that's all for this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for June 30th, 2013. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts every Sunday and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Monday nights. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man Justin and my co-host Persephone. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.